Graphic Audio presents Joseph Narcisse's The Templar Chronicles. This Cleansing Fire. Narrated by Richard Rowan. With performances by David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Bradley Smith, Thomas Keegan, Colleen Delaney, Joe Brack, and Johan Detweiler.
The Learjet banked suddenly, the abrupt action jolting Kate Williams from his uneasy sleep. Glancing out his window, he could see the lights of the city far off to the left, and knew the pilot must be starting his preparations for landing. That meant Cade had roughly another 20 minutes before he and his team would be on the ground, and in the thick of things. Like most of the Order's equipment, the interior of the aircraft was Spartan. Gone were the leather seats and the recessed minibars, the in-flight entertainment centers, and the four-star meals. Only that which was functional and necessary remained, though they had left the privacy curtain that separated the rear compartment in which Cade was sitting from the main cabin just ahead. Looking past the curtain, he could see Matthew Riley seated about halfway up the center aisle. As Cade watched, his teammate stripped his weapon and began cleaning it with deft movements and the ease of long familiarity. At the sight, the voice of O'Malley, Cade's first drill instructor at the academy, echoed in his mind.
If you have no other assignment, see to your weapons.
It was advice he had heeded during his 15-year career with the Special Tactics and Operations team of the Boston Police Department, and which he had brought with him to the Order when he had been recruited. He'd enforced that unwritten rule on his squad from the very first day he'd taken command, and now, 5 years later, it was as habitual to them as breathing. Cade knew without looking that his other team member, Nick Olson, would be in the seat opposite Riley, doing the same thing to his standard-issue handgun.
Having a perfectly operational weapon might just make the difference between life and death for them. Particularly on this run.
The Preceptor himself had asked them to take the assignment, something that didn't happen too often, and therefore couldn't be turned down, despite the fact that Cade felt uneasy about it from the beginning. The situation was not one to inspire confidence. 2 months ago, the local Catholic diocese had requested help through the Vatican in dealing with a particularly violent blood cult. The parish pastor was convinced that there was evil afoot, and believed the local authorities had neither the desire nor the manpower to be able to handle the situation correctly. His request had gone through the channels and apparently had been deemed credible enough for the Order to investigate. Contrary to what most people believed, the Holy Order of the Poor Knights of Christ of the Temple of Solomon, or the Knights Templars as they are popularly known, were not destroyed at the hand of the King of France when he burned Grand Master Jacques de Molay at the stake in 1314 for heresy. Following Molay's death, the Order had gone underground, protected through a secret pact with the Vatican, only to emerge centuries later as a hidden military arm of that organization. Its primary purpose was to defend mankind against the evils that walked in the world, unnoticed in a society that was preoccupied with science and that scoffed at superstitions, regardless of the truths they might contain. In this case, once the Order had agreed that the situation merited a closer look, a team led by a veteran knight captain had been sent in to investigate. Their orders were to look into the situation and assist the parish in whatever manner they found necessary. 3 weeks after their arrival, the team had abruptly disappeared. Using equipment the team had left behind, the parish pastor communicated directly with the preceptor and requested further assistance. Since Cade's team had been the closest and otherwise unoccupied unit, they had drawn the short stick and had been asked to take the assignment. That had been 2 weeks ago. Cade had sent in his fourth team member, Bishop, ahead of the rest of the team, with instructions to set up a secure location unknown to the locals and then rendezvous with the parish pastor. It was standard procedure, and Bishop had carried out both tasks without a hitch, relaying the address of the safe house to Cade during their regularly scheduled communication a few days ago. Bishop had checked in the next night as well, leaving a brief message that said he believed he had some information about the fate of the first squad and that he would see the rest of the team in a few days. The night after that, he'd missed his call. To be honest, Cade hadn't been too concerned at that point. His team was trained to use secondary and even tertiary communication schedules in case of emergencies, and when Bishop missed his call, Cade simply defaulted to the next check-in time. But when Bishop failed to call at that point as well, Cade grew more concerned. By the time Bishop missed the third, Cade had the rest of the team load their gear onto one of the Order's jets and had gotten underway the moment the Preceptor had given them the green light. Now, Cade reached over and picked up the long, thin case resting on the seat next to him. Balancing it on his knees, he opened the case's three clasps and raised its lid. Inside, on a smooth bed of white silk, lay the sword that had been given to him during his investiture, the night that he had pledged himself and his life to the Order, and to its mission of defending mankind from supernatural threats and enemies. The weapon itself was an English longsword. Its hilt had been specifically molded to match the grip of Cade's right hand. Along the length of the blade, facing upright in the case, was the word Defensor, inscribed with silver in a fine script. The Latin word translated as Defender. Cade carefully withdrew the sword from the case and held it up in the aisle, turning it slightly to and fro, so that the cabin's dim light made the script sparkle and shine. According to the code, a knight in the Order was allowed personal ownership of only a few specific items. The sword given to them during their investiture ceremony was one of them, a symbol of their fidelity to the Order and their unrelenting dedication to its ideals. The weapons were supposed to remain undecorated, chaste if you will, just as the knight who carried them pledged to do the same. Enhancing the weapon in any way after it was awarded was cause for a variety of punishments, for doing so was considered a sin of pride. Cade had ignored this rule, just as he had ignored more than a handful of others over the last several years when the success of his missions required it. On the day after the ceremony, he had secretly commissioned a silversmith to help him add a second word to the same exact location on the opposite side of the blade. Now, as he turned the weapon over, he smiled grimly at what was inscribed there.
Ulsicor.
Vengeance. It was the driving reason behind Cade's daily existence, and the true reason for his membership in the Templar Order. He gently replaced the sword back into its case, this time with the opposite side facing upward. Tugging the thin cotton glove off his right hand, he traced the Latin word with the tip of his index finger. He could barely feel the inscription through his skin, but his talent sent the raw emotion locked in it back to him with the force of a thunderbolt. For several long moments, he reveled in the flow as all that rage, determination, and utter hatred for the adversary washed over him like the torrent of a raging river. Just as he had on the day he had awakened in the hospital 5 years before, he vowed once more to find the adversary and make it pay for the loss of his wife and for the changes it had wrought in him. His encounter with that supernatural entity had left him with a scarred face, hands, and soul. It had also left him with several unique abilities, something he was certain the adversary had never intended. The first, what he liked to call his talent, was more properly known as psychometry. When a person handles an inanimate object, they leave traces of their passing on it, a psychic residue, so to speak, as the emotions and thoughts passing through the individual's mind are left on the surface of the object. With just a simple touch, Cade could read those impressions and know something about those who had handled the object before him. The ability had a dark side too, however, for it denied him even the most casual physical contact with another person. Touching someone was far worse than touching an object, for an object held only a few brief glimpses into the individual who last handled it, while a person had all of their pain and emotion locked inside them. Even a casual brush against another person overwhelmed Cade with a sudden influx of foreign thoughts and emotions. He suspected continued contact could even result in a loss of his own identity, as his psyche was overwhelmed by another's, though he had obviously never tested his theory. Because an unintended touch carried with it such a high degree of danger, Cade was forced to wear thin cotton gloves at all times when he was outside the safety of his own home, preventing his talent from activating. His other ability, less troublesome from a practical sense but more disturbing emotionally, he called his sight. Where the adversary had touched Cade's face, nothing but scar tissue now remained. His eye was destroyed on contact, The skin around it melted and cauterized in seconds, leaving so much scar tissue that removing the damaged orb and being fitted with a prosthetic would have been impossible without extensive surgery, something he had no intention of undergoing. In spite of the damage, or perhaps because of it, Cade could now see into the realm of the dead. He could see all manner of ghosts and supernatural beings, not just when they wanted to be seen, which, contrary to popular belief, isn't very often, but any time he wanted to see them. Cade had learned that there was another layer of reality superimposed upon our own, a place he had come to simply call the Beyond. It was within this realm that the dead normally resided, cut off from humanity by the smallest of margins. The Beyond is almost a mirror image of this world, but fashioned out of emotion instead of material substance. The stronger the emotions, the better. It was emotion that allowed a shade to exist, to hang around some particularly important aspect of their former lives. To haunt those places, in other words. Just as an accident victim will wander that lonely stretch of highway where he or she lost control of their vehicle, so too will a murder victim revisit the scene of the crime. The shade of an adult might even return to the home they knew as a child, if such a place held a strong emotional attachment for them. When a person sees a ghost firsthand, it is nothing more than a fleeting glimpse into this aspect of reality. Cade knew from hard-won personal experience that having the ability to see into the beyond had its share of dangers, though. Ghosts and other supernatural beings hunger for the attention of the living the way a heroin junkie hungers for a fix. They quickly take notice when we suddenly drop into their world. Cade had been hounded by all manner of phantoms when he'd spent too long across the barrier. Being on the other side isn't easy either. The real world constantly calls out to you, so your concentration is often split between this side and that. A momentary lack of caution can get you killed in our world, in the beyond. The old saying that there are fates worse than death is more than just a saying. It's a reality to live and die by. The sound announced the lowering of the landing gear, bringing Cade's attention back to the situation at hand. He replaced his sword in its case and sealed it up, before putting the case on the seat beside him. Unbuckling his seatbelt, he got up and walked forward into the main cabin. His men looked up expectantly when he entered.
10 minutes to go. Get those weapons secured and sealed away. Once we're on the ground, Riley and I will unload the gear while Olsen goes for the rental car. I want us loaded and on our way in less than 30 minutes. Hopefully we'll pick up Bishop's trail from there. Any questions?
Both men shook their heads.
Good. If everything goes smoothly, we'll be back at the commandery by this time tomorrow.
Leaving his men to their tasks, Cade went forward to talk with the pilot and see what arrangements had been made for their landing. Cade and Riley helped the pilot unload the four large cases of equipment they had brought with them from the cargo area of the plane while they waited for Olsen to return with their transportation. Each case was locked tightly and was sealed with the emblem of the Holy Seal, making them the sovereign property of the Vatican itself, off-limits to all but their intended recipients. It was the same type of diplomatic protection afforded to the staff members of a foreign nation's embassy, and it allowed the order to move cargo of all types, including firearms, explosives, and supernatural artifacts, about the country with little to no resistance from the authorities. If the authorities couldn't see what was in the box, they certainly couldn't prevent it from arriving at its destination. A few minutes after they'd finished, Olsen pulled up next to the aircraft behind the wheel of a black Ford Explorer. Cade and Riley quickly loaded the gear into the rear of the vehicle before climbing inside themselves. Moments later, the vehicle was speeding out of the airport gate. Without knowing what had happened to Bishop, Cade had no choice but to assume that the safe house was compromised. Instead of going there as had been originally planned, Cade had Olsen drive around for a while until they found a rundown Holiday Inn on the outskirts of town. Cade went inside and reserved 3 interconnecting rooms on the ground floor at the back of the hotel where their comings and goings would be mainly unobserved. Olsen parked the truck in front of the door to the middle room, and they made short work of unloading the equipment. 10 minutes after that, they met in Cade's room. A brief discussion ensued, after which it was decided that they would go to the safe house first, in the hopes that the problem might be as simple as Bishop being injured and unable to make contact. If the place turned up empty, they would do a thorough search of the premises in case he had left a message or some other clue as to his whereabouts. If, after all that, they still came up empty-handed, they would then try to make contact with the church pastor who had requested assistance in the first place. All three of them agreed that the pastor himself might be compromised, or worse, in on the problem from the beginning, so any trip to the church would be treated as a journey into hostile territory. They would secure the premises first, and ask their questions later. Just after sunset, the three of them suited up. Each team member wore a set of ceramic body armor that had been blessed by the Holy Father himself. Black flame-retardant jumpsuits were worn over the armor. In a shoulder holster, each man carried a standard-issue HK Mark 23 45 caliber handgun, complete with a 12-round magazine, a flash suppressor, and a laser targeting device. A combat knife was either affixed to their belts or in a cap sheath on the outside of their boots. Two spare magazines were affixed with Velcro to their left wrists. Their swords, held in tear-resistant nylon sheaths, were slung across their backs, the hilt of the weapon extending just beyond the right shoulder for easy access in the heat of combat. Lightweight Kevlar tactical helmets with built-in communications gear went on their heads. In addition to the pistol, each man carried his choice of personal weapons. For Riley, it was a Mossberg 590 12-gauge combat shotgun. He was also the team's demolitions expert, so he also carried an assortment of plastic explosives and detonators in the chest webbing he wore over his armor. Olsen carried an HK MP5 compact submachine gun, though on occasion he would swap that for a Barrett Light 50 caliber sniper rifle if the situation demanded it. Bishop had been an expert with all kinds of throwing knives. Cade was the only one who didn't carry anything in addition to his standard pistol. His other, more esoteric abilities were all he needed. When they were ready, they left the hotel behind and climbed once more into their vehicle. The safe house was located in a quiet residential neighborhood on the south side of town. A thick stretch of woods occupied the right side of the street, while several older homes occupied the left. Cade had Olsen drive down the street slowly, occasionally using his high beams to illuminate the house numbers painted on the sides of the mailboxes before moving on again. To a casual observer, it would look as if the men in the car were looking for a particular address. In reality, Cade and Riley were using the time to study the target properly, noting entry and egress routes and watching for motion behind the darkened windows that faced out onto the street. After passing the house once and not finding anything obviously amiss, Cade had Olsen drive around the block and pull over in the shadows beneath a stretch of trees lining the side of the road. Cade and Riley slipped out of the vehicle as Olsen brought it to a stop. The night was dark, the sky above covered with a thick curtain of heavy storm clouds. The rise of the moon was still a half hour away. Keeping to the shadows, the two men made their way back down the block until they were hidden in the woods directly opposite the front door of the safe house. Cade gave the signal that they were in position. A moment later, Olsen drove back down the street in the Explorer and parked in front of the house. He flipped on the interior light and pretended to study a map. His companions watched the house carefully, looking for any reaction to Olsen's presence. Nothing.
So far, so good.
Upon receiving the signal, Olsen turned off the interior light and exited the vehicle. The map held in his left hand, leaving his right hand, his weapon hand, free. Olsen walked up and rang the doorbell. The plan called for him to ask for directions to the airport if someone answered the door, while Cade and Riley covered him from the street. If no one answered, Olsen would signal to the others and they would advance on the house themselves, at which point they would enter the home with the key Bishop had previously sent to them. Olsen waited a moment after ringing the bell, and then, after receiving no answer, rang it again. When it went unanswered the second time, he stepped off the front steps, checked the street one time to be certain no one unexpected was watching, and then walked around the side of the house, headed for the rear. Cade and Riley crossed the street and found him waiting at the back door of the house, key in hand. The two men moved into position, and Cade signaled for Olsen to go ahead and open the door. Inside, the house was dark. Using hand signals again, Cade indicated that they were to do a search. The three of them fanned out and went through the small dwelling with the aid of their flashlights, but they didn't find Bishop. They did find evidence that he had been there, though. The refrigerator and shelves were stocked with food, and several city maps lay on the coffee table in the living room next to the briefcase containing Bishop's communications equipment. It was clear that whatever had happened had taken place after he'd prepared the place for their arrival. It narrowed the time frame, but didn't give them any sense of where he might be now. They were going to have to check out the church. St. Margaret's Catholic Church occupied a small, half-forgotten lot sandwiched between two abandoned tenement buildings. The brick with which it had been constructed had long lost its newness, coated as it was by the dust and grime of the city. A small squat rectory was attached to the church itself by a short covered walkway. A broken-down chain-link fence surrounded the property. Here and there, small piles of wind-blown trash could be seen trapped up against the fence in the light of the now-risen moon. Cade parked the Explorer in front of the grounds, and the three of them got out. It was as if the buildings around them were holding their breath, waiting to see what these intruders would do in their domain. Cade could feel the electrical tension that comes from being watched, but didn't see anyone. Perhaps it was just his imagination. They pushed open the gate and made their way over to the church entrance. As they drew closer, they were able to see that the heavy oak doors of the sanctuary were left partially open. Considering the neighborhood, it was a clear sign that all was not right here. They entered the church like it was hostile territory. Riley shoved open the door and let his companion slip inside before taking up a position behind them. Stretching out before them was a large central aisle that extended to the altar 50 feet ahead and divided two sets of pews into equal parts, with aisles stretching down the outside of each section against the walls. On either side of the altar, two small wings formed the horizontal axis of the cross and stretched out of sight. The building was shaped like a cross, and the team had entered at its base. The interior was semi-dark, lit only by the soft breath of moonlight that was streaming in through the four windows that were evenly spaced along the left-hand wall. The red beams of their laser lights danced about in the semi-darkness like the lights at a rock concert, before swiftly coming to rest on the body that had been left lying across the altar at the front of the church. Making certain that the building was clear was the first priority, however, and so the body would have to wait. Without a word, Riley moved to the left-hand aisle, and Olson moved to the right. Cade waited until they were in position, and then gave the hand signal for them to advance simultaneously toward the altar. This would allow them to provide fire support to each other, while at the same time make use of the wooden pews as cover, should it prove necessary. They made it to the foot of the altar without incident. Riley and Olson circled the outer wings without finding anything out of the ordinary, before rejoining Cade at the apex of the central aisle. Only at that point, once they were satisfied that they were alone, did the three of them advance on the body lying on the altar. The man was dressed in the black day uniform and white clerical collar of a Catholic priest. One leg was draped over the front of the altar, the other hung over the side, bent at the knee. The priest's hands were arranged together on his chest, with an antique wooden crucifix clasped upright between them. If it hadn't been for the condition of his skin and face, you might have almost been able to believe he was sleeping. Of course, there was no way you'd ever make that mistake once you'd gotten a close look at what had been done to him. The skin of his face was stretched tightly over his skull, as if the flesh beneath had been sucked away, leaving just the thinnest barrier between the air and bone. Had the man spent the last 200 years baking in the Arizona desert, he couldn't have looked any more drained of substance than he did now. A quick glance at the man's hands let Cade know the condition extended there as well. And from that, Cade guessed that it extended across his entire body. The man's eyes were gone, the empty sockets staring at the ceiling far above. From the position of the man's jaw, it looked like his mouth was frozen open in a silent scream, but the several strips of gray duct tape that were wrapped around his lower face made it difficult to tell for certain.
Vamps.
It was the common name for something that was in truth far more vicious than the blood-sucking monsters immortalized by Bram Stoker's Dracula.
I knew it. I just knew it. Every time you think you rooted out the last of them, another bat shows up in their place.
Shang-Chi.
This was the proper name for the Chinese creatures, but Cade agreed with the general sentiment. If the blood cult that they had supposedly been called in to investigate actually turned out to be a pack of Chang-Chi, he and his team were in for a nasty fight in the not-so-distant future. While his team had never had to face this particular supernatural menace, He had been thoroughly briefed in the past. He did his best now to recall what he had been told. Also known as the Goy-Ren, or demon people, they were some of the fiercest supernatural creatures ever encountered by the Templars. Originating in China in the far distant past, they were now routinely seen throughout Central and Southeast Asia. They had rarely been encountered here in the States, however. Asian tradition claimed that they were formed when an individual dies with an outstanding karmic debt, a debt so enormous that it prevents the soul from moving onward through the great cycle and forces the body to rise again from death in an attempt to see it paid. More often than not, the higher rational aspect of the soul, the hum, becomes dormant in the process, leaving the po, or the lower bestial aspect, in control of the resurrected creature. Neither truly living nor dead, the Changshi were creatures without qi, the essence of life, and therefore must constantly steal it from the living in order to sustain their existence while seeking to redeem their debt and rejoin the great cycle. No other creature left such damning evidence in their wake, making them easily identifiable for hunters like Cade's team.
Identifying them was the easy part. Finding and defeating them is another matter entirely.
Leaving Olsen on guard, Riley and Cade did a more thorough search of the church, looking for anything that might indicate what had happened to the missing advance team, Bishop, or the church staff. After an hour of searching, they came up empty-handed, which left them only the body itself, and with it, the need for more drastic measures.
I'm gonna need to take a closer look at the priest's corpse.
Cade stripped off his gloves and put them in his pocket to emphasize his intent. Both of the other men had worked with Cade before and knew exactly what he intended to do. They took up guard positions around the altar, their attention focused outward, ready to protect Cade when he was unable to protect himself. For his part, Cade barely spared them a glance. They knew their job, and he trusted them to do it. Instead, he stepped up to the altar, bent over the body, and examined it more closely. The priest had been middle-aged. His thinning gray hair and liver-spotted skin gave evidence to that. A close look at the shrunken flesh of the right side of his face revealed a large bruise. The black cloth of his shirt and pants was ripped and tattered in certain places, mainly about the arms and lower legs. Cade glanced at his men, received a nod of confirmation from each of them, and then turned back to face the corpse.
Time to get to work.
There was no way Cade was going to use his talent on the body itself. The priest had no doubt suffered greatly at the hands of the Changshi, and Cade had no desire to relive any of that experience. Not like that. Instead, he was going to take a reading from the surface of the altar, in the hopes that it would filter enough of the horror out of the encounter to allow him to understand just what had happened here. Cade mentally prepared himself for the task ahead. Using his talent was never easy. It physically drained him of energy at an alarming rate, leaving him weak and disoriented for several long minutes afterward. The need to constantly guard against being overwhelmed by another's thoughts and emotions made it mentally demanding as well. Staying immersed too long in the flow made it difficult for him to regain his own identity. And though he had never tested the theory for obvious reasons, Cade believed that his physical form could be affected by what he was seeing through his gift as well. When he was ready, he reached out and laid his palms flat on the altar's surface. Hands carrying him, perversely caressing him, while others seize hold of his arms and legs and haul him bodily into the air.
Our Father.
Movement.
Who are they?
A whisper of bodies parting to get out of the way. He's dropped onto a hard surface. The altar? And his limbs are pulled out and away from his body, his captor's claws, as they expose the skin of his wrists and legs.
Hail Mary, full of grace!
The cloying scent of rancid meat hangs in the air. More hands seize his face, forcing his jaws open. The taste of something metallic as an object is shoved into his mouth, while gnarled fingers snatch at his tongue. Pain, terrible pain, as his blood flows freely, filling his mouth. Cade snatched his hands away from the altar top, the coppery taste of phantom blood sharp in his mouth. When he looked up, Riley and Olsen were staring at him expectantly.
Vamps, all right.
He pulled his gloves back on.
And a lot of them. And they left us a calling card.
Cade reached out held the forehead of the corpse with one hand, and with the other, yanked the pieces of duct tape off its mouth. The mouth sprang open and locked. Cade peered inside it, and then reached in with two fingers to draw something out. He held it up for the other men to see. It was a gold signet ring, set with a ruby stone in the shape of a cross. It was identical to the ring that each team member wore on their right hands, the same rings they were given on the night of their initiation into the Order. On the reverse side, directly beneath the stone, were three initials. J.K.B.
Bishop's ring.
Cade handed the ring to Riley, removed the glove on his right hand, and then extended that hand back toward his teammate again.
You sure you want to do that, boss?
We don't have any other choice. They obviously want us to know they have Bishop. The ring might be able to tell us if he's still alive, and if he is, where they might be keeping him.
Shaking his head in resignation, Riley gently dropped the ring into his teammate's open palm. Pain. A deep throbbing pain that pulsed in his left side, right where the vamps had slashed him with his own weapon. He knew he was still bleeding. The wet trickle that marched down his ribcage and under the waistband of his pants clearly told that story. His right wrist hurt as well, where two of the vamps had locked their vile mouths on his flesh before their leader had stopped them from draining him dry. He was bone weary, evidence that the two junior vamps had taken a fair amount of life force from him before the stronger one had intervened. Still, he was alive, and while he was, he had no doubt that Cade and the others would make an effort to rescue him, which meant he had to stay that way long enough for them to do so. He knew he was in the warehouse district. He'd seen as much when they'd grabbed him at the church. While he'd been unable to determine the exact location of the building to which they had brought him, he had been able to catch a glimpse of the sign out front.
Markham's slot.
The vision ended as abruptly as it had begun, but it was enough. A quick search of a phone book was all they needed after that. Markham's Slaughterhouse was located on South 52nd Avenue, near the intersection with Grand. Riley went out to the car and returned with his computer equipment. Using coordinates from a GPS device and some mapping software, he quickly pinpointed the exact location of the warehouse in relation to their current position. It was less than 15 minutes away. Neither Olson nor Riley were surprised when Cade suggested they head directly for the warehouse. The fact that Cade had read anything at all off of Bishop's ring meant that he had been wearing it sometime in the last 48 hours. An object couldn't hold a psychic impression longer than that. 48 hours was a long time to be trapped in the hands of the Chang'chi, but the possibility remained that their teammate might still be alive. They couldn't take the chance and leave him at the mercy of the vamps. They had to try to get him out, as he had known they would. Cade had no intention of going into a nest of vamps without someone knowing what had happened to them, however. Using Bishop's computer equipment, he sent a coded email directly to the Perceptor, informing him of everything that had occurred to date and letting him know what they planned to do next. If they didn't return, at least the Order would have a sense of what was going on and could plan an appropriate response to the situation. Cade had every intention of surviving, but it never hurt to be prepared. The warehouse seemed to be deserted. Cade and his fellow knights stood just inside the entrance, their weapons held at the ready. The cavernous interior of the warehouse stretched away before them, illuminated by a series of old arc lights strung across the ceiling. A few piles of discarded crates and equipment lay in the far corners of the room. One of the lights shone down directly on the bruised and bloody face of a man whose slumped body was tied to a support pole halfway across the room.
Bishop!
Cade looked carefully around the interior of the warehouse, searching for any sign of movement either in the shadows that lined the walls or among the rafters and catwalks that stretched high overhead. Nothing. At Cade's nod, the three men cautiously made their way across the floor to their fallen comrade. While the others stood guard, Cade knelt down beside the pole and gently touched the other man's face. Bishop's skin was icy cold.
Too late.
Keeping one arm around his teammate, Cade leaned around the pole and cut through the cords that bound the body to it. With its support suddenly released, Bishop's corpse slumped against him. He gently eased Bishop onto his back on the floor.
There.
Just to be certain, Kate leaned in close and listened for a heartbeat. Nothing but silence. Kate raised his head and looked down at his teammate's dead face, burning it into his memory. Cataloging another victim he would now have to avenge. Bishop's eyes popped open. His hungry gaze met Cade's confused one, and a wicked grin scurried across his lips.
Sorry, boss.
His hand whipped toward his former leader, a razor-sharp set of talons extending from his fingertips and seeking Cade's face. At that exact moment, no doubt the result of some prearranged signal, the rafters suddenly vomited a scurrying, seething horde of ravenous creatures that descended the walls with spider-like grace and came rushing across the warehouse floor toward Olsen and Riley.
It's a trap! Yeah!
Kate threw himself away from Bishop and out of reach of those deadly claws. His warning was unnecessary, however, for Olsen had already caught sight of the swarming horde. Riley quickly joined the fray. Cade caught all this peripherally, as he was too busy rolling away from his opponent while trying to stay out of reach of those claws. He came up in a crouch, his pistol held securely in his right hand. Bishop had already risen to his feet. As his enemy came charging toward him, Cade triggered his sight. In the beyond, the warehouse was a darker, more ominous place, full of the shadows of pain and suffering caused by the slave-driving mentality of its owners. Here, the true nature of the team's attackers also revealed themselves, as their thirst for the team's life force was an almost physical presence, pulsing out from them in waves of need and desire. There was no mistaking the fact that the warehouse was full of very hungry Chang'Chi, nor was there any doubt as to what had happened to Bishop. Cade calmly noted his former teammate's altered condition, his savage hunger, his unholy rage, and his dual existence in both the real world and in the beyond, and then he was out of time. His former teammate rushed in to savage him. Cade fired point blank into the man's face. Bishop went down hard with a bullet hole just beneath his right eye. In the 15 seconds it had taken Cade to dispense with Bishop, Olsen and Riley had littered the warehouse floor with vamp bodies. But still, more of the creatures swarmed up the rafters high above and charged toward them. Worse yet, many of those who had gone down were now starting to get back up.
Go for the legs!
When it was clear that they hadn't heard him over the roar of all the gunfire, Cade stepped up between them and directed his own fire at the legs of his opponents. It only took a moment before his companions caught on to what he was doing and followed suit. Soon, however, their supply of ammunition began to dwindle, then disappeared altogether. As one, the knights dropped their guns and drew their swords. The vamps closed in, anticipating an easier time of things now, only to discover that the knights still had plenty of bite left in them. In the face of the savagery of the knight's defense, the vamps retreated to the darkness among the machinery in the far corner of the warehouse. The three living men took a moment to catch their breath.
Bishop's gone!
Cade glanced over to his right, where he had left Bishop's body before joining the fray. That section of floor space was empty. Olsen was right. Bishop was gone. But had he gotten up of his own accord, or been dragged away by his comrades? Before Cade could ponder the question further, the vamps attacked again. This time, they came drifting in and out of the beyond, so that Olsen and Riley were mostly unable to see them coming. The vamps streaked in toward them at inhuman speed. Flickers of motion they caught out of the corner of their eyes and desperately tried to counter. The vamps had not counted on the changes the adversary had wrought in Cade, however. Cade's sight showed the vamps clearly, even when they stepped fully across the barrier into the beyond, where they believed they were safe. Cade danced in and out of the battle like a whirling dervish, his sword flashing in the light, striking his foes with savage grace. But his fierceness was not enough. By the time the vamps retreated for a second time, all three of the knights were bleeding from multiple wounds, and their energy was getting dangerously low. They would not be able to hold off the vamps for much longer. Across the floor, the knights could see their enemies gathering together again, preparing for another assault. They must have abandoned their previous tactic, for they were clearly visible to all three of the Templars. Grimly, the knights waited for the onslaught. Much to their surprise, it did not come. At least, not yet. The milling group of Cheng Shi suddenly parted ranks, and an Oriental woman of extreme beauty stepped to the front of the group. She was dressed in a traditional Chinese gown of flowing green silk that matched the emerald hue of her eyes. Her midnight black hair flowed loosely across her shoulders and down her back, where it hung almost to the floor behind her. One hand held a Chinese war fan across her upper face, and even from across the warehouse, Kate could see the gold lacquer that covered nails several inches in length. Behind her, like a faithful servant, came Bishop. His face bore the evidence of Cade's marksmanship. A large swatch of flesh and bone had been torn away just below his right eye. It did nothing to dim the unholy light in his eyes, however, and only served to increase the hatred in his heart for the living knight standing before him.
Why have you come here?
Cade ignored the question and gave the standard Templar response when encountering a supernatural being.
Your kind is not welcome in this place. You are an insult to the Lord. Renounce your evil ways and let the Order send you to the rest you deserve.
You get better at that line all the time, boss.
Cade ignored his comrades, though their quiet humor in the face of almost certain death made him proud. He had trained them well. He did not expect the Cheng-Chi princess to accept his offer, but the demands of the code required that he offer such succor to any supernatural creature he encountered. It was a throwback to the days before the Inquisition, when the Order would offer surrender to all their foes before resorting to force. Personally, he thought it to be complete foolishness, but he had taken a vow to follow the code, and where it did not conflict with his own personal mission of vengeance, he strove to do so. Besides, it gave him a few more precious seconds to try and figure a way out of their current predicament, and that alone was worth it. The woman's razor-sharp teeth flashed in a smile.
You are as arrogant as the commander of the last team that invaded my territory.
She indicated Bishop with a disdainful wave of her hand.
Like this one here, I will make you into my personal lapdog for your audacity.
Cade smiled, and all the hatred he'd harbored for years against the agents of the darkness spilled forth from his gaze. He raised his weapon in front of him.
I think you'll find me more difficult prey than my lieutenant, but feel free to give it your best shot. At the very least, it should make for an exciting end to what has been a fun evening.
Spittle dropped from the Cheng-Chi leader's lips. With a wave of her war fan, she gave the signal for her troops to attack. Cade and his men braced themselves for the onslaught, knowing that they had very little chance of surviving. The Cheng-Chi dashed forward. Suddenly, the front ranks of the ravenous creatures were cut apart like confetti. Startled, Cade glanced over his shoulder. High above, on one of the catwalks that crisscrossed the building, stood the members of a second Templar assault squad. They lay down a blistering wave of covering fire over the heads of Cade's group as other members of their team began flinging hand grenades into the seething mass of oncoming vamps. Under such overwhelming firepower, the Cheng-Chi stood very little chance of surviving. From his position on the opposite side of the warehouse, Cade watched the vamp leader scornfully turn her back on her followers and disappear back into the darkness. With a last angry glance at his former leader, Bishop followed suit. Without their leadership directing the attack, the remaining vamps were made short work of by the Templars. When it was over, the commander of the second combat squad walked over to where Cade knelt on the floor, tending to an angry-looking but otherwise shallow wound on Olsen's back.
Why is it that Echo always gets the fun assignments?
Charlie Team's commander was known for his humor in the face of danger, but this time Cade didn't feel like joking in return.
You call this fun? I think it's time you got your head examined, Davis.
Nah, I already know I'm nuts. I don't need some shrink to confirm it for me.
Yeah.
Cade shook Davis's hand. Charlie Team had pulled their ass out of the fire tonight, and Cade was thankful for it. He just didn't understand how it had happened. When asked, Davis just shrugged.
Maybe the big man upstairs is watching out for you.
With that, he wandered off to direct the cleanup efforts, leaving Kay to tend to his wounded teammates.
That bitch got away, boss.
Bishop, too.
I know. We'll deal with both of them at another time. For now, let's just get you two out of here and back to the commandery. We'll debrief there.
After he'd gotten his men settled in the truck, Cade turned and gave the warehouse one last look. The doors were standing wide open now to admit the Templar cleanup crews that were already converging on the warehouse to wipe it clean of any trace of the Jiangshi. By morning, there wouldn't be any sign that they'd been there at all. But Cade knew that wasn't the last time they'd be hearing from the charismatic vamp leader or the former Templar who now walked at her side. The Order had encountered another enemy today, one to add to the ever-growing list of evils that would have to be dealt with before long. But that could wait for another day. For now, it was time to take his team home.
The Templar Chronicles, This Cleansing Fire, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2011, Joseph Nassis. Production copyright 2011, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Published by arrangement with Joseph Nassis. All rights reserved. Performed by Richard Rowan, David Coyne, Thomas Penny, Bradley Smith, Thomas Keegan, Colleen Delaney, Joe Brack, and Johann Detweiler. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing and graphic audio sound design by Johann Detweiler. Story adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed This Cleansing Fire, be sure to look for the continuation of the Templar Chronicles, coming soon in graphic audio. Also, be sure to look for Peter V. Brett's The Demon Cycle and Brent Week's The Lightbringer Trilogy, all available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio. Graphic Audio presents Peter V. Brett's fantasy masterpiece, The Demon Cycle. Book 1, The Warded Man. Experience a world filled with hardship and pain. By day, humanity struggles to carve out an existence in a land that wants nothing more than to see it fall. By night, the broken rabble cowers behind magical wards, its only protection from the relentless bloodthirst of the demon plague. But just as the light threatens to fade away forever, and shadow is poised to shroud all in its wake, three survivors will band together to do battle with the savage horde. Led by a mysterious, fearsome warrior known only as the Warded Man, humanity will wage a bloody war against the creatures of the night. A war that could bring it to the very brink of destruction, or capture its final salvation. Don't miss the savage action of The Warded Man, Parts 1 and 2. Coming soon in graphic audio.
Where to get him?
before he passed out. Curly said he got him twice, once in the leg and once in the neck.
When Smoke's friend and longtime foreman Pearly is bitten by a deadly mountain rattler, Smoke must venture into a dodgy gold rush city known as Payday.
What's wrong with your friend? He shot or something?
No, he's been snake bit real bad. We came here looking for a doctor.
The nearest real doctor's up in Pueblo, about 50 miles from here.
Damn.
They bet we do got us a dentist, and he takes care of most of our doctoring when we need it.
But when Smoke gets Pearly the only aid he can find, he crosses paths with someone from his past. Someone hell-bent on revenge.
How long you gonna let this Jensen thing distract you, Buck? Every day you sit around here messing around with this Pearly character trying to get to Jensen, we're losing money.
I'm gonna do whatever it takes to first make Jensen's life a living hell, Jeb, and then I'm gonna kill him. If you don't like it, there ain't nothing you can do about it.
But the only thing this oily varmint didn't count on was Smoke Jensen's boiling, unstoppable wrath.
Now, I don't know what you have against me, Tolliver, or why you've gone to so much trouble to hurt my friend, but I'll find out sooner or later, and we'll have a reckoning, you and me. You do know, don't you, Buck, that only one of us is leaving this town alive.
The streets run red in The Mountain Man number 32, Wrath of the Mountain Man. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. Or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different graphic audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.